I was a prize fighter, you'd still knock me out.
Good morning, Bert Sugar.
Good morning, Vinny. How are you?
We're very good, and I have with me here John Spehor of Fighting Fitness and the Bridgeport Sound Tigers. Bert Sugar has written just about something like 80 books, just an ungodly amount of books. He's the most preeminent boxing historian. He's been in some movies. He actually had been a lawyer. He earned a law degree at one point and worked in advertising, and he's a very ubiquitous and irreverent figure. So, Bert, welcome to the program.
I'm trying to figure out who you're describing.
Bert, that was quite a buildup. I was speechless as well.
Well, I don't want to admit it, but I did pass the bar, and it's the only bar I've ever passed.
Not even a limbo? You know, you've not gone under the limbo bar. You know, I had wanted Bert to introduce you as Runyon-esque, and then I thought, you know, I'd better look that up. Bob Costas calls Bert Runyon-esque. And I look up Damon Runyon, and he talks about writing about the characters of the demi-monde.
Well, but New York had so many of them, and albeit I'm not originally a New Yorker, I'm from Washington, D.C. and Richmond, Virginia. I guess I've been here so long, they've either adopted me or they. And I'm sort of called that. I have no idea why. Maybe it's like someone like Nicely Johnson, as he had him in Guys and Dolls.
I think, Bert, one of the things that I think is a more accurate descriptor is I think that you can very well be compared to a modern-day Piers Egan. Because a lot of some of the phrases that you've coined over the years are similar to Egan's in that regard.
Well, don't tell anybody Piers Egan has been dead for 250 years.
That's our secret. No one's going to know.
You know, one of the things about this book, Bert, and we want to talk to you about you, not just Angelo Dundee, but I do want to plug the book. The latest is My View from the Corner, A Life in Boxing. Angelo Dundee with Bert Randolph Sugar and a foreword by Muhammad Ali. One of the things I was struck by, Bert, was the lengths that corner men will go to get their fighters motivated. There's some wonderful details and anecdotes about Emil Griffith was slapped once out of a trance by his corner man.
Gil Clancy, and he tried to hit him back.
Doc Bagley, a trainer, ran a lit flame up and down his fighter's back.
Yeah, anything. Please, help. You see, a trainer is not just a water bucket carrier. They are many things, from almost a surrogate father to a psychologist, to a hand wrapper, to a cut man, to a dietitian, to everything you want to think of. There are more sides to a good trainer than there are to a Rubik's Cube. And Angelo Dundee is one of the best in all time. Yes, put him in there with Ray Arcel. Yes, put him in there with Freddie Brown and some of the others. Go back to Doc Bagley. But Arcel and I think Angelo are two of the best.
How did this book come about, Bert?
Well, I had Angelo on my show on ESPN Classic called Ringside several times, and we sat there and we told stories at and to and with each other, and adding to each. And we figured, why don't we put this on paper? Why should it just be an oral, not a written history? And Angie was very interested, and then a book publisher, McGraw-Hill, came to me, and I said, I got the book. And after 3.5 months, it's going into its fourth printing, and it's on the threshold of becoming the biggest-selling hardback book in boxing publishing history.
Disproving the notion that boxing books don't sell.
Exactly right.
They do sell if they say something. So many of them are just me, and me books.
Right.
I mean, Angelo's in there telling stories, as you pointed out, Benny, on Doc and Ray Arcel and everybody else. So he's incorporating. He's becoming the storyteller. And I kept it in Angie's, if you will, pattern of speech. Some editor, while I was sending in the copy, was going, what is Marone? What is Ajita? I'm going, would you get the hell out of the way? You know, I got some wasp editing some Italian's book.
That's a nightmare, Bert, a nightmare. You know, the book reminded me of what Angelo Dundee talked about as the atmosphere at the Neutral Corner. Now, was that a bar or a restaurant where people would come?
It was both.
And they would come after being at Stillman's Gym. And people with names like Yussel and Mo Fleischer, and they'd sit around and talk all night about the fights and about their fighters.
Well, I love the names, and particularly, you know, in the mob, and he was, peripherally there at the time of the Carbos and the Blinky Palermos and the Gas Pipe Vacones, you know, good names. There was a guy in the mob called Honest Bill, and I won't fill in the last name. And the reason was he never stole a train.
Which made him incredibly honest.
Yes.
Here we go.
By standards. I mean, everything is relative, and except maybe Eve telling Adam about all the men she could have married.
How did the technical aspects of putting this book together work? Now, I'm picturing you and Angelo sitting together, which may be a mythic image to begin with. Maybe you did this by phone. And he's talking and you're typing, or you're recording him?
I'm just listening.
You're listening.
That's all you have to do.
That's all you do.
You know, some people do tape recordings. I can't figure out how to turn the damn thing on. Ben Heck, the great writer who wrote many, many things, including Front Page, used to have a system where he'd interview people with a pad and pencil in his pocket, and he could write into his pocket without them seeing him write.
My goodness.
So there are ways of recording, but I can remember what somebody says and play off of it, and if I have a question, then I call them. And there was one funny thing I just must confide in you, and it's just between us guys. I once, in the Foreman chapter, I wrote a line that went, George Foreman's retirement and comeback after 10 years was the greatest career move since Elvis died. Well, I sent that chapter to Angie, and then I sent it to his son, Jim, who parsed it. Angie would go, great, he just wrote that, and he'd drop it in the corner. Jim would read it for every word, his son. And I get a call from Jim, you can't say that. And I said, why? He said, Dad doesn't know Elvis is dead.
A rude awakening.
Yes.
You know, Bert, along the same lines of things that folks don't know about, and you meet millions of people, I'm sure, every single year in Canastota at the International Boxing Hall of Fame induction weekend. And I was one of those millions of guys. And you and I talked at a reasonable length regarding the great Roberto Duran, which you do talk about in My View from the Corner. And one of the things that I had mentioned to you that weekend was, gee, Roberto seems a little standoffish to the crowd. And you said, because he's always had to live down the no mas, no mas, which he never said. Tell our listeners a little bit about that story.
Well, he went home in disgrace after the second Leonard fight, where he is reputed to have said no mas, which was really said by Angelo Dundee. What he said is not repeatable.
Absolutely not.
But what he said, what he meant was, I came here to fight, and this clown, meaning Leonard, doesn't want to fight. He's winding up. He's sticking his tongue out. I came here to fight. If you look up the word machismo in the dictionary, there's his picture. And he's there to fight, and here's Leonard just doing whatever in the hell he can. And he just walked away. He walked away. But he never said no mas. But that's become a catchphrase that's supposed to be theoretically descriptive of him. And Roberto, and today, Roberto is a lovable grandfather. I mean, you could pinch his cheek like you do your uncle or your grandfather. He's just lovable. To give you an instance, he was inducted into the Boxing Hall of Fame last year. And I'm seated at dinner with him on the night before the dinner and then the induction. And in comes Ken Buchanan. Now, just as a little background to the listeners, when Roberto beat Buchanan in 71 for the lightweight championship, it was not a pretty fight. He wound up by hitting him somewhere south of the border, and Buchanan doubled up in pain. The first thing these two guys did was hug each other and laugh. I mean, it was almost inconceivable. But Roberto today is a lovely, gentle person, and he's full of life, and he's full of laughs. And I think by now, he's gotten over that nomos, because his career as a total or a totality has overcome that. You look at this man, and he's one of the greatest fighters of all time, and assuredly the greatest Latino fighter of all time.
You know, you mentioned Angelo Dundee saying no mas, that it was he who said that, meaning no more, correct?
Well, yes, but it was Angelo put to rest that rumor that he ever said it.
But he actually didn't say it. You know, I was thinking about the one time in the book when Dundee says he had to stop a Muhammad Ali fight and how it kind of broke his heart. It was with Holmes.
Larry Holmes.
That was a very poignant chapter. You know, we really can't talk about this book, My View from the Corner, without talking some about Muhammad Ali.
Which is half the book.
And, you know, I found it just incredibly riveting. This book is a great read. The first time Angelo Dundee hears from Cassius Clay, as he was known at that time, Clay was in Louisville, and he had been a Golden Gloves champion, and he's trying to get Dundee interested in him. And eventually they get together, and Clay pursues Dundee. Dundee describes him as very strong-willed, somebody that who could recuperate very quickly from a hit. And they bonded in this beautiful alchemy, the two of them together, two unlikely buddies.
Well, here in the foreword, and I'm just reading it to myself now, so I'll read it to you. Muhammad Ali says, when he turned into the Nation of Islam and became what the white press called the Black Muslim, Ali said, "He never said I was wrong. He never asked why I joined the Muslims. He never said anything about it. That is one reason I stayed with him. Of course, he was a great trainer, too. But through all those days of controversy and the many that followed, Angelo never got involved. He let me be exactly who I wanted to be, and he was loyal. That is the reason I love Angelo."
Well, I think, you know, we that brings up a really good point. We talked about a lot of the different hats a trainer wears. And one of the ones that you mentioned was a surrogate father. But, you know, the other one, too, is especially with the Larry Holmes fight, as a trainer, you have to be, to a certain degree, Bert, the bad guy. You've got to stop the fight because you've got to know that your fighter, based on his pure will alone, will not quit.
Well, not only that, you're there to protect him. Right. You're there to incite him, but you're there to protect him.
And Ali had a strange, I don't know if strange is the right word, Bert. Maybe you can think of a better connotative word, but a strange entourage. I mean, one of the guys that Dundee talks about a lot is this fellow Boudini,
who's the one who coined, and Angelo gives him credit for it, "Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee." And Angelo, scratching his head, just said to me, "I thought butterflies flitted, not floated."
This is what I love about this book, is that all of these great moments in history and things that have come into our lexicon and have come colloquial are explained and revealed in this book. It's like the hidden history.
Well, it's, you know, boxing has so little oral history. We know who landed a left in what fight. We know who knocked out or decisioned a man in what fight. But very few people know what went on behind the scenes in that fight. So it's not just the result. It's not just what happened. It's what happened. Angelo always going in and looking to see the dressing room and how close it was to a bathroom. You know, things that nobody thinks about. These are what trainers do, but he also has insights into people. You know, Sugar Ray Leonard, Carmen Basilio, Muhammad Ali, assuredly, just people. And he's handled 15 champions, and he's proud of every one of them, but he's just as proud of some of the men who didn't become champions, the Florentino Fernandezes and others, who challenged, didn't quite come across, but he knows he gave his all, and they gave their all to him. I mean, he's particularly fond of Willie Pastrano, albeit he had to keep him under some sort of wraps because Willie was always wandering around looking for two-legged wildlife.
Was that the guy that was pretty early in the book?
Yes.
He was involved with Willie?
Yeah, Willie was a light heavyweight champion. Didn't wind up well. His friends took him astray once he was out from under Angelo's purview, if you will. But Willie was a funny man and a nice man. And Angelo, he's the one that was in the room with Angelo when Cassius Clay called from downstairs in Louisville. But he also was a hellraiser, would be the nicest thing I could say.
I've got a little something to play for you, Bert. It's a little piece of audio, and I'll set it up as being the night before the famous Clay Liston fight. And I'm calling him Clay at this point.
The first fight.
Yes, he was. Okay.
And
this turns out to be the fight where he says to Dundee, "My eyes are burning. Something is on Liston's glove." So this is just the night before.
You recite something and I'll make up the music. For a change, do the one about you.
This is the legend of Cassius Clay, the most beautiful fighter in the world today. He talks a great deal and brags indeed of a muscular punch that's incredibly speedy. The physic world was dull and weary. With a champ like Liston, things had to be dreary. Then someone with color, someone with dash, brought fight fans running with cash. This brash young boxer is something to see, and the heavyweight championship is his destiny.
Do you recognize that?
Oh, yes. What was that, Cabot?
That is the Jack Parr Show.
Oh, Jack Parr, because he did it on Cabot, too.
February 24th, the day after my birthday. And
congratulations on a birthday.
Thank you so much.
I'm not counting anymore, so you can count for both of us.
I'm barely counting. February 24th, 1964. Cassius Clay and Liberace on the Jack Parr Show the night before that fight. Was there something on Liston's gloves?
Angie says yes.
Now, is it, Bert, this is what I've heard in speculation, that Dundee said to the ref to go over and check the gloves. The ref couldn't find anything on the gloves, so then the speculation became that the liniment or whatever it was that was on Liston was on his body somewhere. They say potentially the top of his head or maybe his shoulders. What do you think?
Well, two other opponents before that fight, Zora Foley and Eddie Machen, they complained about it, something in their eyes. So it just sounds like too much of a coincidence, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Now, of course, we know the rematch is arguably the most famous boxing picture ever taken by Niels Leifer, Life magazine, standing over a fallen Sonny Liston yelling, "Get up, sucker." Now, of course, it has been speculated over the years that fight Liston completely threw. What are your thoughts on that?
No. If you look at the pictures, you can see Liston's leg go up when he gets hit, and then he topples over. And then, after the referee, Jersey Joe Walcott, maneuvers Ali to a neutral corner because he was having trouble, and never counted one, let alone nine, let alone ten, Liston gets up and starts fighting again. He just was, according to Liston, this man was crazy standing over him. He would hurt him if he got up. But even more important, go back one step. You played for me the Ali tape of Ali rhyming things. You know who did all those rhymes for him?
Angie.
Angelo. And he was so, I mean, you know, like, "Joe's going to come out smoking, and I ain't going to be joking. I'll be pecking and poking, pouring water on his smoking. This might shock and amaze ya, but I'm going to retire Joe free." Now, Ali, Angie said, "The only problem I ever had with him changing his name is I couldn't rhyme Muhammad."
Absolutely right. It's like rhyming orange. It's a very, it's a challenging word.
Yeah, good for you. But, you know, this is, Angie was there. He was part and parcel. He was the other half of Muhammad Ali or Cassius.
Bert, were you at all those fights that you're talking about?
I was at several of them. I don't say all of them, but I was at several of them.
Let's talk about another mythical thing that the great Angelo Dundee did. One of the great things that you have to love about Angelo Dundee in the corner is he didn't sugarcoat things. And the fight that I have in mind is the first Sugar Ray Leonard fight against Tommy Hearns, where Angelo looked him dead in the eye and said point blank, "You're blowing it, son."
Yeah, and he did. And Ray, that round, went out and rocked Tommy and took him out the next round.
Right.
He has an eye for things. Angie also is one of the wiliest people I've met in the corner. In one fight against Ernie Shavers at Madison Square Garden, Ali was in a fairly tough fight. And it was that fight that NBC decided as a novelty that they were going to announce the scorecards after every round. but not to the fans in the arena, but only to the television audience. So Angie sticks somebody in the locker room watching TV who runs out and flashes the signs to him, thumb up, thumb down, flat palm. He won, he lost, it was a draw. And so he knew with four rounds to go that Ali couldn't lose if he stayed on his feet. He knew how to work a fight. People still say that before the last round of the Sugar Ray Leonard and Marvelous Marvin Hagler fight, his getting up and cheering as Ray went out for the 12th and final round, new champ, that away, new champ. And that gave the judges a view and a sort of a misleading but leading determinant as to how they gauged the last round, which gave Ray the championship.
Absolutely right. You know what? I think that fight also, you know, you get boxing fans, aficionados, on any bar stool in the country, and they will argue that fight to the death. Who won that fight?
Only from New England. Only from New England.
Well, because you know, I think we liked Marvin in that fight, Bert. I was in a little teeny hall in Bangor, Maine, watching that fight on pay-per-view, and I could have sworn, and I watch it to this day, that Sugar Ray Leonard simply did not take the championship from
Marvin. You
don't
have to take
it.
You have to win a fight. The belt doesn't hit anybody. And if you remember that fight, Marvin gave away the first three rounds fighting right-handed.
Right, right.
So I defy anybody to tell me he won seven of the last nine.
This is part of what has really compelled me, an unlikely boxing fan, Bird, about this sport, is that the fights become legendary and they become reflective of larger issues in our culture, be they economic, social, political. I remember being a little girl and my father watching the Gillette Friday night fights, Bert, and he was like, you know, going, you bastard, get him, get him, get him, get him. My father smoked a big cigar, by the way. And
I identify.
A man after your own heart. You know, I hated the smell of the acrid cigar smoke, but every year on my dad's birthday, I would go to Abe's tobacco shop and say, let me have one good cigar. And he'd pull out of the humidor maybe a Romeo and Juliet.
Juliet, yes.
Thank you. And I would get to keep the case. You know, it was in this nice silver case, but I digress. So I'm watching, I'm probably like a little girl, and, you know, I'm playing with my braids on the floor, and I'm thinking, this is a vile, disgusting, brutal sport. And the odd fact of it is, Bert, is that I've now become a complete boxing fan, and through the help of John Spehar of Fighting Fitness sitting here, my coach, an avid recreational boxer myself, and my particular area of interest has become Jewish boxers. And as you mentioned before, we had all these incredible names, and you shared with me some of them on the telephone earlier. Let me pick your brain a little bit about the contribution of Jewish boxers between 1910 and 1940.
No, we even go back. In 1930, six of the eight champions were Jewish. There were only eight divisions then.
Why is this something no one knows?
I don't ask them. I mean, most people don't even know anything before ESPN went on the air. I mean, I told my son he wouldn't know he was getting a divorce unless it ran on ESPN.
Excellent.
I mean, people don't know history. Boxing is a reflection of the social ladder of America. First, it was the Irish fighters when they had signs in the windows, NINA, no Irish need apply. And John L. Sullivan and James J. Corbett became their standard bearers. Then it was the Jewish fighter, starting with Leech Cross and Benny Leonard and on and on. And then it became the Italian fighter. And then the African-American or black fighter. And now it's the Latino fighter. Each group at the bottom of the social ladder has used boxing as a rung-by-rung way up into the, if you will, societal middle class. And the Jewish fighter, coming off the Lower East Side and in, out of other places, was a major part of it. Of course, many of the early Jewish fighters changed their names to Irish names because that was reflective of the time. There was one, Morris Shear, who fought under the name Moshe Callahan, became a junior, I think, welterweight champion. He did such a good job at changing his name, his son became a priest.
Well, you know, Barney Ross, who was Beryl Rasofsky,
yes,
changed his name because he didn't want his mother to know that he was fighting.
Same with Benny Leonard. He was Leonard. When I boxed, I was Burt Randolph. I didn't want my mama to know. I was amateur. I'm not telling anybody I was good. My nickname was the Great White Hopeless. But I boxed amateur. And I kept coming home with cuts, and I tell her I fell down. She must have thought she had the clumsiest kid in the world.
One of the boxers I read about used to pack a suitcase full of ties when he was heading out for his fight.
King Levinsky.
There you go. We're on the same page, Bert.
Yep, and King Levinsky.
He would say to his mom, I'm a tie salesman. But in the suitcase were his gloves and his wraps and all that.
Listen, that's no different than Joe Louis, whose mother thought when he went to the gym he was going to violin lessons.
I mean, it's meant a lot to me in terms of some rediscovery of my own history and some of the immigration woes that my relatives face, to realize that the myth of Jews' non-athleticism is just that, a myth.
Well, you know, it goes back to, you know, the book learning. They were supposed to be bookish. But there was a whole area in Brownsville in the 20s and early 30s where you had two ways out. You either went into the mob, and there was a Jewish mafia, or you went into boxing. Like Al Bummy Davis, who went into boxing, and his brother went into the mob.
Right.
So, you know, it depended on where you turned to become a part of society.
And the infamous Frankie Carbo, who got a reputation as being the czar of boxing.
Mr. Gray.
And was mentioned in this book, My View from the Corner, worked for Murder Incorporated, which apparently was a group of men.
That was Louis Lepke Buchholder.
Right, who my father met once, who would be on call 24/7 to handle any problems that afflicted La Cosa Nostra. So it was a group of guys, mostly Jewish American hitmen from the Brownsville section of Brooklyn. They operated out of the back of a candy store.
Well, I'll even tell you a story on a story. One of them was Sid Luckman's father, the great quarterback at Columbia for the Chicago Bears.
No way.
Yes. And Sid would never talk about him, obviously. But, you know, it was a tough time, the Depression, and people turned. I'm not trying to sugarcoat it in any way, excuse it. I'm trying to explain it. Murder Incorporated, Kid Twist, Relis, there were several of them. Big Greeny. I've written papers on this.
Kid Relis slipped off of a hotel building the night before he was scheduled to testify before
yes,
the Senate
yes.
subcommittee. Terrible
out
accident.
Out in Coney Island.
Yeah.
The line was, canaries can sing, but they can't fly.
We're talking with Burt Randolph Sugar, preeminent boxing historian. The radio station.
It was the Half Moon Hotel. It just occurred to me.
What a memory.
The
radio station is WPKN 89.5 FM Bridgeport and WPKM 88.7 FM Montauk and on the internet at WPKN.org.
Don Ross wrote a wonderful book about Murder, Inc. and Bummy Davis and all those guys. And he talks about Kid Relis. And one of the things that they kind of hearken back to, and this is a theme that Benny and I have discussed a lot now, is there's no nemesis for our boxers today. I mean, certainly when you think of the heavyweight championship fight, you think of Dempsey Tunney, Lewis Schmeling, you think of Ali Frazier. And, you know, this thing in Madison Square Garden last month, Abramanov and Klitschko,
mm-hmm.
I think it demonstrated the decline of our sport, Bert. Any thoughts?
No, just on the heavyweight side.
Just on the heavyweight side.
Yeah, you know, what they proved, you know, that was a fight I was at. I had to tell the fella in the press row, the row ahead of me, to quit snoring. He was keeping me awake. I mean, it was a terrible fight.
Horrible fight. Horrible fight.
I raced over to the bar across the street from the garden at the what used to be the Southgate Towers. Now I think it's the Afanina. Right after the fight, I didn't wait for the decision. I had it 8-4 at the end. That wasn't rounds. That was punches.
Absolutely.
And I get over there thinking, boy, I'm going to get a seat at the bar. And it was packed with people who had left in the third and fourth rounds.
Horrible fight. You know, and one of the challenges, I think, about that fight, not so much the fact that it was, first of all, it was a ghastly fight. But secondly, I don't think very many people knew Sultan Abramov before the fight. So people came into this.
They certainly won't know him now.
But let's contrast this to the exciting fight last Saturday night in Vegas of Manny Pacquiao.
I was there. It was. I had Marquez winning by a point. It was. Anybody who hasn't seen it, it's on Saturday night again on HBO. Exciting fight. And it's, you know, when you say this is what's happened to the sport, look at what's happened to the sport. We're getting great fights in the lower weight classes.
Right, right.
Now, this happens almost every time the heavyweight division is in decline. It happened back in the 30s, before Joe Louis came on the scene, where the heavyweight champions were clownish Primo Carnera and Max Baer.
Right.
And we looked at the middle area weight classes, and whom did we find? Probably three of the greatest fighters of all time. Jimmy McLarnon, an Irishman. Tony Canzoneri, an Italian. And Barney Ross, a Jew. And they put on fights, they fought each other, that filled the stadiums. Or, if you took your Latin, stadia. And same thing happened in the 80s. Larry Holmes was defending his title against the likes of who weren't even household names in their own households, like Osvaldo Ocasio. And so we looked at the middle area weight classes, and we found a Duran and a Leonard and a Donnie Hearns and a marvelous Marvin Hagler. Well, the same thing's happening today. We're finding fighters like Joe Calzaghe and Floyd Mayweather Jr. and Manny Pacquiao. And if anyone thinks boxing is dead, I got to tell you, about 3 weeks ago for a fight in London, England, they had 20,000 people in the O2 Arena packed at 2:30 in the morning to accommodate U.S. television time, singing and cheering. I mean, boxing is, behind soccer, the second biggest sport in the world.
Let me ask you, Bert, with that said, of course, I'm sure that you've heard the waves and the noise being made by the mixed martial art community and the Ultimate Fighting Championship. Is this a fad? Do you think that this thing is going to overtake boxing, has been predicted?
Boxing's not losing one person to that. I got to tell you, if you haven't got 20 tattoos, you can't go.
That's right.
It's bar fighting without broken beer bottles.
Right, right.
It's what I did as a kid. And it's emblematic that they hold it in a cage.
And here's what Angie Dundee says to you. And then there's a new entry on the list of sports offered to sports fans, what the Washington Post calls that gruesome junk. Some call it human cockfighting. Others, bar fights without the beer bottles. There you are. But whatever you call it, this new phenomenon has captured the imagination of younger fans.
Well, what it is these are the ex-wrestling fans who have substituted cartoon violence with real violence. That's all. I don't think boxing's lost one fan to them. They built their own constituency.
You know, I got to say, Bert, I am
so... And it's sort of the Chia Pet of sports. It'll be gone before we know it's there.
I can't tell you how reassured I am to hear you say this. Because
I don't see anything that bothers boxing on that. The numbers aren't there. Yes, it's all over excellent cable channels like Versus, if you can find it.
Right.
Well, good.
We're told sports today. I mean, you look at ESPN. I didn't know Texas Hold'em was a sport.
Or spelling bees.
Yeah, spelling. I mean, it's a wonder. Call me when it's topless volleyball.
An Olympic sport, to be sure.
Well, I'm reassured to hear you say this, Bert, selfishly, because I'm working on a memoir. It's called Blows to the Head, How Boxing Changed My Mind.
Well, you know, Joyce Carol Oates became a big boxing fan the same way you did. Her daddy would put her on his lap to watch the Friday night fights up in Buffalo.
There are a few differences between me and Joyce Carol Oates. She said that boxing could not be a metaphor, that boxing was the thing itself.
In part, she's right, but I disagree with her, because why has boxing been the subject matter of more movies than all other sports put together? Because on that canvas, you can paint a different canvas. those participants are basically naked. They're out there in underwear. It might say Everlast on them. But you can see everything they do, and you can really use them as your word, a metaphor, Joyce Carol Oates's, for anything.
Absolutely.
The ability to overcome, whatever it is you want to make your story.
And I don't know if you've noticed this, Bert, but I've been very struck by the proliferation of boxing metaphors to depict the current Democratic presidential race. Now, this is an odd phenomenon if you think about it. I did a little survey of it recently, and they're constantly talking about it this way. Ever since Hillary held up the gloves given to her by Kelly Pavlik in Ohio and said, America needs a fighter, the metaphor-hungry media ran with this like crazy. Now they're saying that that Obama has a glass jaw and Hillary's a dirty fighter and it's going to go the distance and it's going to be like the thriller in Manila. And I maintain that these usages are happening because boxing has such staying power.
Well, boxing is an easy, and using the word again, metaphor. I haven't heard anybody say throw their hat in the ring. But
which was, by the way, can you tell us the origin of that term?
Yeah, it goes back to Theodore Roosevelt using it.
Well, I think also it was a way where the early boxers in the gentleman days would indicate their interest in being in the ring with an opponent.
Yeah, that's one of it. But it really, Theodore Roosevelt coined it. And then there was Harry Houdini, who after he had an argument with his wife, would always open the door and throw his hat in, and if it didn't come flying back out, he could go in.
Bert, we could talk to you for hours, and I really don't want to keep
hats
you.
Hats, I know. Hats, I know.
Hats, you know.
Hats, you know. Fedoras is the market, no question.
Well, when it gets summer, they go to Panama. And one last hat story, quickly, is that the hat trick in hockey came about because in Chicago, when a Blackhawk scored 3 goals, everybody would throw their hat on the ice in celebration.
Ah, Bert, you have no idea how excellently that segues into our next part, because I also, besides being a boxing trainer, work for a professional hockey team.
Well, the hockey players and the boxers are the two nicest groups of people, athletes I know.
You are preaching to the choir. I have been telling our listeners that now for a month. Absolutely right. I agree.
Here's a question.
And one of my best friends, don't ask how, but I'm an honorary member of the Italian-American Sports Hall of Fame.
I wonder.
And I go out to Chicago, where it is, and I always wind up with Tony Esposito.
No way.
And Tony is one of the nicest, most wonderful people you've ever met. I was sitting there with him at the at a BAR, dare I say bar, last year, and he was telling me about some hockey player's drinking problem after he'd finished his seventh drink.
Okay, guys, here's the question. What famous Jewish boxer wore a white fedora? Barney Ross.
Barney Ross.
I would have said Abe Attell.
That is fedora trivia, Bert, that we need to take with us to Canastota this year.
Yeah, I would have said Abe Attell, who was a featherweight champion and then wound up, along with Arnold Rothstein, as one of the fixers of the 1919 World Series.
Oh, that's right. Absolutely.
Bert, can we talk to you again?
Wait, can I ask him one more question?
We're like little puppies at the window.
Because I have to be somewhere by Sunday.
Yeah. Bert, real quick. Now, again, you know we're New Englanders, and you know there's, when we look at you, you talk about Boxing's Greatest Fighters in one of your books. You have a DVD that's incredibly successful about the top 10 heavyweight contender champions of the world. And everybody, I'm sure, has razzed you regarding your placement of the great Rocky Marciano. Why is he so high in the list?
Why is he so high or not so high?
Not so high. Well, not so low. When you think 1 to 10, I don't know.
Yeah, but Rocky, unfortunately, was penalized by history. One of my criteria for really gauging a man's greatness is to meet and beat other greats. Mm-hmm. Rocky came along in the 50s, and by that time, the heavyweight division was Rocky Marciano and the Seven Dwarfs. His six greatest fights, His six greatest fights were two against Joe Walcott, two against Desert Charles,
right,
Joe Louis, and Archie Moore.
An aging Joe Louis, should be noted.
Yeah, and the average age of those six fighters at the time he met him was 40.
Right. And Desert Charles arguably never really was a heavyweight.
No, and neither was Archie Moore.
Right, absolutely
not. He was light heavyweight champion, albeit, trivia fact, Archie Moore outweighed Rocky Marciano in that fight.
Is that right?
But, you know, so it's not that he's not great. His 49-0 is the second greatest sports mark after Joe DiMaggio's 56 consecutive games.
Right.
And 43 knockouts. It's that his opponents were not as great as some of, like an Ali.
Agreed.
Not as great in terms of their greatness.
Speaking of Marciano, let me put in a quick plug for the American Association for the Improvement of Boxing. Steve Acunto and Rocky Marciano, who you've been talking about, founded that organization in the 60s.
Yeah, Steve is a lovely, gentle person. You know, and I had the pleasure of knowing Rocky, who, only thing I ever held against Rocky, he had the worst toupee I have ever seen.
And people bought it, but he bought it, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean,
he needed a hat.
I don't know what it was. I think he went to Woolworths on sale.
What's under your hat?
I don't know. I've never taken it off.
Don't tell her, Bert. There you go.
And then there's the notion that was in some film I saw where a hat on a bed was bad luck.
That's an Italian notion.
Oh, is that true? This is a true thing, then?
Yeah.
Sort of like Malocchio, the evil eye.
Yeah,
there's the hat on the bed.
The hat on a bed is a terrible, terrible omen.
Well, possibly our next interview with you, Bert, could be about hats.
Oh, I can be had. You know, like, they went out of fashion when John F. Kennedy didn't wear one to the inaugural in 61.
I heard
he also didn't wear an overcoat.
Yeah, but the overcoats are in fashion because of the weather. But hats... In fact, the first group to endorse John Kennedy was the Danbury Hatmakers, and they were so upset.
Unbelievable. You know what I heard? I heard that the hats went out of fashion when the cars in Detroit started making the hood smaller, or the roof smaller, so you couldn't get in your car with your hat.
You slumped.
Yeah, that's what I heard. I heard that, too.
No, it was John F. Kennedy, not wearing one on the inaugural, because they were always Homburgs before that.
Do you have many hats, like the same one, but
no,
you have
no,
like
I
10
have,
of them?
I have two hat trees, and then I have a third hat tree that is filled with hats that I've collected over the years. When the Metropolitan Opera has a sale, I'll go down and pick up a tri-cornered hat from HMS Pinafore or Roman Gladiator hat from Aida.
Bert, this is a whole show. You know that, right?
Yeah, this is clearly a whole show.
This subtle idiosyncrasy that you have is worth exploring, I think.
It's probably beyond that. It's almost an obsession.
Well, we deal with obsessions here.
But we do. This is our niche, right?
It's a volunteer radio station. We're alternative. We are nonprofit. We are beholden to no one. So if we want to do a show with Bert Sugar about hats, I'm your girl.
Let's do it.
Bert, right. I can't thank you enough.
And I appreciate it, and I'm going back to work now on my baseball book.
Oh, and do you want to put in a little plug for that? When should we expect to see
when
that?
When I finish it.
Okay.
No pressure.
It's on the Baseball Hall of Fame. They've asked me to do their official book.
You know, I have a quick observation about that, and I think we got to let you go. Our program director is hanging himself in the other room. But anyway, there was a thing came out just recently that they found a document, I believe it was in Worcester or Lowell, that documents existence of baseball around 1751.
And well, you know, Doubleday is Abner Doubleday, for which Cooperstown gets the Hall of Fame.
Right.
He had about as much relationship to the founding of baseball as the Easter Bunny has to Easter. I mean, as long as there's been a stick and a ball, and that goes back, what, to the cavemen?
I would imagine.
There's been a game similar to baseball. That was a town ball, round ball, one a cat, two a cat, and it existed. The reason it's given to Cooperstown 1839 is because some half-demented man claimed he went to school with Abner Doubleday. And at the point that they did the study in 1908, the Americans wanted no, if you will, they were confident and cocksure of their place in the world. They wanted nothing to do with anybody who said the ancestry came from England or anywhere else.
Right.
Well, this baseball conversation is going to be juicy. Burt Randolph Sugar, who, with Angelo Dundee, has a new book out, My View from the Corner, A Life in Boxing. It's been a pleasure. Can I put you on hold? I want to talk to you briefly.